Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. This week, we inaugurate a new president. Remarkably, a majority of Americans view the incoming president unfavorably even before he takes office. Many are deeply concerned about what Trump and the Republican Congress will do to undermine programs and values we treasure, including our very democracy. Our guests today are actively engaged in dealing with the challenges presented by the new administration. Our guest for the first half hour is Milagros Phillips, who will talk about healing the racial divide in America, which is sure to intensify in the coming years. Our guest for the second half hour will be Barbara Wien, professor at American University, who will talk about the many protests planned this week in Washington, D.C. and around the country, including her experience organizing a teach-in invaded by right-wing saboteurs. Milagros Phillips specializes in transforming relationships between the races with humanity and compassion. Her new book, Eight Essentials to a Race Conversation, is a manual to a new dialogue on race. She's also designed a program, Race Demystified, a Compassionate Approach to the Healing of America, a powerful experience that leaves participants empowered and hopeful, which she has brought to Fortune 100 companies, colleges, universities, and communities throughout the country. Ms. Phillips was the founding executive director of the National Resource Center for the Healing of Racism. She served as expert in residence for the Kellogg Foundation, and she developed an approach for congressional conversations on race in Washington, D.C. Milagros Phillips, welcome back to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me back, Eleanor. It's wonderful to be here with you.
Oh, it's great. I'm so excited about this conversation because we need it now more than ever.
I am too.
So I want to start with the basics, for people who may not have heard of your work before, but you've devoted so much of your life to healing race in America. Why does race matter?
Race matters because even though we look at ourselves as a society that is, at times we look at ourselves as post-racial, the reality is that race is still impacting every area of American life, from education to healthcare to even what children have for lunch at school is impacted by race. So for me, race is such an important topic. There's healing that's needed on all sides, and it really is America's journey. It's an important part of American life, and it's important for us to look at it.
So true. And, you know, this racial issues are so heavily charged, and, people of all races get anxious about the conversation, it seems to me. And there's been some of the kind of beating up and pressing on, white guilt by whites for white privilege, and then, but you don't understand what it is to be a person of color, and there is white privilege. So, it can be very ugly, actually. But I attended your workshop on transforming race, and I just thought, I've been to many workshops on dealing with the race issue, but a lot of them, I think, actually caused damage because they were not done in a healthy, respectful way and just kind of raised issues and got into this attacking whites for privilege, and it just was like not good. Is there anything that can set us back? But your program I found very compassionate. It's historically grounded. So it really helped me a lot to be able to talk about, because I was nervous as an, white Irish coming out of Boston, like, just don't talk about it because you're going to say something stupid or wrong or offensive and you'll regret it and you'll be dead. So, but I love what you do. So I want to talk about your new book in a minute, but first let's start with your Race Demystified program, which is so incredible, and you've helped so many people with it. What about that program makes it so moving and successful?
Well, that program, first of all, is historically grounded because let me backtrack a little bit. I came to look at race from the perspective of healing, as opposed to anti-racism. There are people who do that, and they do that really well, and that work needs to be done. But I knew that I needed healing. You know, I joke and I say I was healthy enough to know that I needed healing. And so so I embarked on that process, and I looked at, well, how do people heal? How do people heal from trauma? How do they heal from pain? How do they heal physically, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually? And I just threw myself into learning and understanding healing.
Healing from trauma generally, like emotional trauma.
Yeah, emotional, even physical trauma.
Physical trauma.
That people suffer.
Interesting.
Yeah, if somebody has an accident and their body can go into shock because the whole physical structure has been traumatized. So there are different levels of trauma. So I really wanted to kind of understand, and again, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I knew that there was a connection between all of these. So one of the things that I realized early on was that I didn't know enough about the history. As I started to learn about the history of race in America, that really began my healing process. I began to understand what was happening today based on understanding what had come before. And so my programs are based on that, and also based, the reason I have so much compassion for people, regardless of the color of their skin, who come to these seminars is because I knew what I was like. I know what I was like when I was ignorant, when I didn't know the history, when I didn't understand it.
Uh-huh.
And I was trying to tackle a problem I think it was Thoreau that said, for every person that's beating at the branches, for every 100 people beating at the branches of evil, there's only one beating at the root.
Uh-huh.
You know,
right.
And so for me, it was, is how do you get to the root of this thing, so that the healing can happen from the inside out.
Uh-huh.
So in my program, Race Demystified, what I do is I give people the historical background that grounds them in a deeper understanding of what it is that they're dealing with today. Because for the most part, we don't learn that history in school. We don't, you know, it's not in the newspapers. It's not anywhere, really, for the most part. I mean, now, when I started doing this, there was no Internet, right? Now we can at least research things on the Internet.
Uh-huh.
So there's a greater ability to become race literate. But for the most part, people don't know. And so trying to have a conversation about race from the perspective of today is not enough. And that's where people falter.
Uh-huh.
That's where people get trapped because they don't have enough background information to understand what it is that they're dealing with today. So Race Demystified, and I have a Race Demystified program coming up in February, on February 10th and 11th, actually.
Where is it?
It's in Adams Morgan.
In Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C., yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone wants information, I can give them information when we're finished. But, you know, for me, this thing is about what is it that we're really healing? What is it that we're really looking at?
Uh-huh.
You know, I always remind people when you go to the doctor, you got to do the history because they need to understand your past in order to understand what's happening today. And so so my programs give that as background. And with that as background, it makes the conversation easier. Not because the history is a very difficult history, but by letting people know what they don't know, some of what they don't know, gives them some background.
And if I can say, having taken this program, and it was so phenomenal, that what I experienced was, instead of pitting black versus white, you joined kind of black, white, Asian, everyone, Native, together looking at our story and our past and where do we get from, how do we get here, that's created the context within which our relations happen.
Exactly.
So that was so beautiful.
And for me, you know, it's really important, you know, when I tackle this thing that, you know, I always begin the programs with history, personal history, as well as, you know, the larger context of the nation's history and how that relates to the global history at the time and that type of thing. But for the most part, I want people to have that background before we look at healing. Because when they have that background, then they're able to understand, oh, that's why I feel this way. Oh, that's why I look at things from this perspective. You know, it really gives them, you know, I help them explore their personal history and how that personal history connects to the collective history. And And what that does is it takes away a lot of the stigma around having that conversation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the conversation is difficult because people just don't have enough background with which to tackle it. And so once you give people that, it opens up a new dialogue. It allows them to talk about race from a slightly different perspective.
Yeah, that's so good. And from, I would say, a much less charged conversation, which is what we need right now, because it, you know, it's elevated intensity right now, and it's all, I think, only going to get worse with the new administration coming in. And you said in a prior conversation on this program that after decades of leading conversations on race, you've concluded that what we need in America is a massive educational campaign focused on retelling the American story.
Absolutely.
And I would say, is that kind of your definition or description of a conversation on race, that we need kind of a national conversation on race?
Well, you know, for me, in order to start that national conversation on race, we need to help people become race literate.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was joking with a friend of mine last week, and I said to her, so I speak Spanish and I speak race. Do you speak race? You know, because in order to have that conversation, we need to be race literate. And race literacy it gives people that background, as I said before. But what it also does is it gives a place from which to begin the conversation. So the conversation is no longer about what you did and what I did. The conversation is we have this common history.
Uh-huh.
The reason that I start the programs with the history of Asian Americans, African Americans, Latino Americans, all these various groups and what they've gone through in the U.S. is because we need to understand that this issue impacts all the groups that are here, regardless of the color of their skin. And from there, we move on to, you know, now that we understand all of this, how do we heal? And how do we heal in an environment that is still toxic? You know, because we're still dealing with a lot of these very, very dangerous things. You know, race can cost you your life in this country,
uh-huh.
even today.
Uh-huh.
And so so having a deeper understanding, becoming race literate, and being able to have a dialogue that not just transforms but also inspires is extremely important. You know, when I do my seminars, I don't do them to convince people of anything. I do them to share information. People can choose if they want to do the transformation work. That's a personal choice. But at least they'll be doing it from a place of information where they're better informed around what this is. And after, you know, more than 25 years of doing this work under some very difficult circumstances, I decided to write. I wrote that first book that I wrote was 11 Reasons to Become Race Literate. There are a gazillion reasons, but I chose 11 because that gives people a start, and it leads them, it gets them to ask questions and hopefully do some research, even if it's just on the internet, on some of the historical pieces that are in that book. And what I realize is once you awaken, then you're probably going to start to have conversations with people in your life, in your family, in your schools, at work, and so on. Because when you start to learn, the natural thing for people to do is to share what they're learning, which then leads to a race conversation. So book two is about how to have a conversation on race. It's 8 essentials to a race conversation. And in the back, I put a little manual, pulled some pieces out of the text that people can use if they want to hold these dialogues with friends, with family, with community, and so on. And I also give permission for people to copy the back of the book so that they don't have to contact me. They can just, you know, copy it at will and use it to have these conversations, because these conversations are so important.
Right. Well, it sounds like we kind of have a two-part seminar, if you will. And the first part is understanding our story as Americans. So that's kind of number one, understanding our story, how we all got here and all
right.
that context. And then once you've got that...
you're demystified.
Once
yes.
you've got that understood,
yes.
more historically grounded, then we can have the conversation. And mm-hmm. it's interesting you're saying that, because You know, so many times we hear the calls for let's have a national conversation on race, and we all thought it was going to happen when Obama was elected president, and then it never really happens. And as you're talking, it seems to me what I'm getting is that it's not the place to start.
Right.
That the place to start is understanding our story.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's a prerequisite to that conversation.
Yeah. You got to take that class first.
Yes, exactly.
And then once we get that going, then we can have the conversation on race and do it from a much more grounded place.
Exactly. And then I actually have book three, which I'm hoping to have out. I was hoping to have it out by the end of this month, but that's not going to happen. So I gave myself a little bit of an extension. With book three is about the healing process, taking people through the layers of healing. Because what happens is once you start to have these conversations, you open up the wound. And when you open up the wound, what do you do? Where's the salve? You know, like, how can I wash this wound? And what happens to me as I begin to open up in this way? And so that's where the healing process comes in. And so so book three is about understanding the eight stages of healing and what that means and what it looks like for us as individuals and as communities and as a nation.
So let's be clear for our listeners that you already have one book. Book one's been out, and the name of that is?
11 Reasons to Become Race Literate.
11.
And it's available on Amazon.
Okay, 11 Reasons to Be Race Literate. Mm-hmm. And you just came out with the book two that you're talking about now, which is right here in front of us, The Eight Essentials to a Race Conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about The Eight Essentials to a Race Conversation. This is your new book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why did you write this book now?
So I wrote this book because, again, after spending 25 years holding these conversations and getting people to open up about race, I realized that, when people start to have these conversations, they often get they feel trapped. First of all, they don't even want to start the conversation because they're so afraid of doing it wrong.
It's like going to the dentist.
Yes, exactly.
Even like worse, because if that hurts, it's not your fault.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And so having the background that I have and the understanding, as you know, I've done this work with global leaders, with national leaders, with corporate leaders, with educators around the country. And the thing that's that was really salient is people just didn't know how to get started.
Right.
So I decided to write the book because it isn't just about how to get started, but it's how to move through the conversation. So what are the layers of the conversation? What are the things that you need? Like listening is such an important piece of that conversation. We don't always, sometimes we listen, but we don't hear.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is when it comes to the issue of race, we keep hearing people say, oh, we just keep repeating, going over the same thing over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, people repeat themselves because they don't feel like they've been heard.
Right.
When people feel heard, they don't have any need to keep repeating.
Right.
And so hearing and listening is extremely important to that conversation. So I spend some time talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, resistance. You know, when you start that conversation, you may feel resistant within yourself, but the people you're having the conversation with may become resistant to what you're saying, to what you're sharing with them. And so I have a section in there about self-preparation. How do you prepare yourself to have those conversations? Because they are important. I'm currently working on a race and health project, and the understanding that people's lives are at stake, and if we don't speak race in conversations about healthcare, then there's this huge missing piece. You know, your healthcare provider should be able to speak to you about intergenerational trauma, about historical trauma, because all of those things are affecting us today. We don't always acknowledge that, but it's real. You know, we now have enough research to know that trauma gets passed on, and if trauma is not healed, you pass it on. And so, it's just a very, very important conversation to be able for a doctor to have with their patient. But if the doctor is nervous about having that conversation, and if the patient isn't receptive to that conversation, then we're not going to get very far.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me, you know, we've all been seeing over the past couple of years kind of the explosion of the police versus, you know, black most particularly. And, you know, my heart bleeds for the mothers of these young black men everywhere because the fear of just having your son out there, like what's going to happen today? But at the same time, you know, my father was a police officer, so we know blue lives matter too and black lives matter. And yes, all lives matter, but our cities seem so on edge. I don't know whether it's just they've gotten more attention or there's more militia equipment in the cities or what's going on, but it just seems to have dramatically increased over the past couple of years. So it really seems to me it would be very helpful if we had this kind of understanding our story and then followed on by conversations about race in all our cities.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. That would be, you know, and here's the interesting thing about having that conversation in all of our cities. It's that every city in this country has a racial history. And to discover that history is so fascinating. For instance, one of the things that I did here in D.C. is I started a program called Untold History Tours, where we would take people on historical tours of D.C., but it wasn't the regular D.C. tour. It was about some of the hidden history of D.C., some of the places where people used to hide when they would come here from the Underground Railroad. So, you know, just things that people don't necessarily know and they don't get on the regular tours. And, you know, and every city has that. New York City has it. Boston has it. Every city in this country has a racial history. And so, you know, one of the things that would be fabulous in beginning this national race literacy campaign would be to have the cities tell just, you know, short, almost commercial-like programs on talking about some of the race history in those cities. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the black soldiers, the first people, I mean, who was the first person to fall during the Boston Tea Party and the Revolutionary War? It was a black man.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, so being able to tell those stories so that our children and everyone in the community can learn about the history of people who weren't just European and of European descent, but other people who contributed to the building of the country. You know, it would be fabulous if every city kind of took on that as a task to re-educate the children of the city, let's say, you know, where the parents and the children can then have a discussion around the table during dinner, the dinner hour. That would be so fascinating and so interesting and so different. So it would just be amazing. And the other thing that it would do is it would give us our history. People sometimes forget that black history is, in this country, is American history. So we're missing this huge part of American history in our education. That's why I say, do you speak race? You know, because having that awareness, having that information really helps to change not just minds, but it helps to change hearts. And ultimately, that's where the change takes place. Mm-hmm. The real change, the lasting change, takes place in the heart. And so, and the other thing is that I've seen so many people change. Some hardcore guys that used to come to my seminar. I used to do a 2-day. Now I do a 1.5-day because people just don't have time, right? But in that 2-day seminar, even the more hardcore guys, by 2:00 in the afternoon the second day, when they went through that healing process, were completely transformed. And so for me, that's why I keep doing that seminar, because I know that it works. I know that it
changes lives.
Yes, it absolutely does.
Absolutely, right. Well, what would you say to a mayor? You know, I just have spent the past couple of days at the U.S. Conference of Mayors here in Washington, D.C., and I love the mayors, and they're like, make it happen, people. They get their feet to the fire, they're close to the people, and they have decision-making authority and budgets, and they can get stuff done, as they say. So what would you say if you were talking to a mayor, like what would you advise a mayor do in this area to try and promote greater understanding and cooperation and peace in mm-hmm. their community.
Sure, sure. I would say the same thing that I tell everyone, start with the history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at the race history in your community, look at the race history in your city, look at the race history and how that history relates to the history of the country. And also look at how that history relates to individuals in the, you know, that are in your cities. Because the telling of those stories begins to sort of crack the shell that people have built around themselves around race to protect themselves or to stay out of it or, you know, whichever side they happen to be on. And so what I would say to mayors is start a city race literacy campaign.
Race literacy campaign, race literacy not a conversation campaign. On race.
No.
All right, we got it.
Let's not go there yet.
All right.
Because what often happens with these conversations, I'm not saying you should never have conversations. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying that if you're going to do this in a big way, if you really want to do this to transform, then let's start at the beginning. Let's give people some a grounding rock that they can hang on to, so that they understand what it is that they're really talking about. And then once you've done that for a while and you feel like that's made a difference, then start these dialogues. You know, in the meantime, you're still going to need people to have dialogue in smaller groups and so on and so forth. But if you want to do like a large city transformative campaign around race, start with that history.
So it's kind of like learn the language first. Mm-hmm. That's the race literacy. Once you learn the language, then you can speak the language, then you have the conversation.
Exactly. Yeah. And what I would also say to mayors is don't wait to have to be reactive. Be proactive. Start now. You know, bring people together to figure out how do we start this campaign? How do we get things moving in that direction? And once you figure that out and you've got this campaign going, it's a great campaign because you can get young children involved and have children's contests and all kinds of wonderful things to get the little ones involved, as well as, you know, getting your local historians and the elderly who remember when. You know, getting those stories down and having them tell those stories, because that's the other thing is that we don't always engage our elderly while they still have reason and can tell the story. And so we're missing a vital part of some wonderful stories that are part of our cities. And so getting some of these folks to tell some of those stories is really, really important.
That's great. So the book is Eight Essentials to a Race Conversation by Milagros Phillips. And how can our listeners get the book?
So they can go on Amazon and just put in Eight Essentials to a Race Conversation. It'll come right up, or they can put my name and both books will come up, Milagros Phillips. And they can also join me at the Race Demystified and the Healing Process. On February 10th and 11th here in Washington, D.C. And then the other program that I have is based on the second book, which is Eight Essentials to a Race Conversation, Transform the Way You Speak About Race. And that program is actually going to be February 25th, also in Adams Morgan in Washington, D.C. And they can email me or they can call me. My phone number is 301-332-5782, or they can also go on Eventbrite. The programs are on Eventbrite, and they can go on the Eventbrite website and put in Eight Essentials to a Race Conversation or Race Demystified, and the programs will come right up.
That's fantastic. Well, I encourage our listeners to read your book and your books now. Yeah. And also go to that program if they can at some point to access that. I hope maybe you can do that online or something through YouTube or something like that down the road.
Yeah, I'm working on that, actually.
Very good, very good. So that's all the time we have. Milagros Phillips, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Eleanor. It was a pleasure.
Our next guest is Barbara Wien, professor at American University, here to talk about the protest plan this week in Washington, D.C. and around the country, including her personal experience organizing a teach-in that was invaded by right-wing saboteurs. Barbara Wien, welcome to All Together Now.
Good afternoon.
So thank you so much for taking the time. I know this is a very busy week for you, and you've got all kinds of activities you have planned and are planning, and you're right in the middle of everything. So thanks for being here. Let's start by tell us about the teach-in that you helped to organize at American University this past weekend.
Well, there have been many events at AU, many conversations, dialogues, teach-ins, and trainings, where people are trying to make sense of the upcoming presidency, the upcoming inauguration. So starting last fall, right after the elections, faculty were holding discussions in the dorms because many students were feeling unsafe, feeling very threatened by the rhetoric, by the escalation of hate speech and critical incidents actually around the country. So there were many teach-ins going on in the dorms, in the lounges, certainly in class. And I facilitated a peacemaking circle with U.S. veterans that had come back from war, from Iraq and Afghanistan, along with the Black Student Alliance, the President's Task Force on Diversity and Inclusion and others, because we had had a flag-burning incident on our campus, and people really wanted to go deep about that and discuss with each other across the conflict. And they came together with a really great understanding. So there was a lot of healing that went on in that circle and a lot of deep observations and insights to come together as a community. But the discussions continued after the winter break, after finals and the holiday. And this past Wednesday, we on the 18th, there was a huge teach-in involving many, many faculty at American University's campus and hundreds of students. And this was part of a broader teach-in that happened on hundreds of college campuses on the 18th of January, looking at how we can be unified in our common humanity for justice and peace, for nonviolence, interracial understanding. Last weekend, we held a training about labor rights and threats to labor rights and workers' rights, threats to social justice, to minorities. How can we respond nonviolently? So there were multiple nonviolence trainings at AU, and they were led by veteran nonviolence trainers from Greenpeace, the civil rights movement, the labor movement. That went on for 3 days, all day Saturday, all day Sunday, and all day Monday. We moved to St. Stephen's Church of the Incarnation on 16th and Newton Street Northwest in Washington, D.C.
So you're involved in organizing these nonviolence trainings and kind of teach-ins that started at AU and moved to St. Stephen. But was this connected?
I'm one of many. There's
one
a very,
many.
Very large coalition. There's never just one person that does mm-hmm. these things. I was just one small cog in a much bigger wheel of people coming mm-hmm. together to collaborate and cooperate. There are mobile nonviolence trainings going on all over D.C. and all over the nation this week. They're very nimble, flexible, and adaptable, smaller-scale nonviolence trainings. And I want to explain a little while later the nonviolence trainings that have been happening or will happen on the buses coming in for the Women's March.
Oh, interesting. So you're saying that this is connected to some activities that are happening not just in D.C. because of the inauguration, but all across the country.
Yes, in the United States, we have a vibrant, very, very powerful civil society movement. And there are many, many threads to this beautiful fabric, this beautiful civil society social fabric that underpins our country. And we've had a very strong tradition of volunteerism and civil discourse, civil society, and civil rights in the United States, you know, for a long, long time, whether it be the Rotary Clubs, the Lions Clubs, the Kiwanis Clubs, the League of Women Voters, the Optimist Clubs, and, you know, many, many kinds of civil society groups, the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, 4-H. And now we see a new generation of civil society organizing that's very, very ubiquitous. It's insinuated itself into the connective tissue of every community in our country, and that involves the environmental movement. They are trying to protect clean air, clean water, clean up bays, whether it be the San Francisco Bay or the Chesapeake Bay. You know the successes they've met in cleaning up the Hudson River, thanks to people like Pete Seeger. They've stopped very damaging pipelines that would have poisoned the aquifers and damaged the sacred burial grounds of Native American peoples. So the environmental movement is very highly organized and visible, mobilized, deeply, deeply trained. They have fierce discipline and training and strategy. And then, of course, we have the women's movement, which is highly, highly structured and organized in many, many places. They also take on foreign policy questions as well, matters of war and peace. We're going to see evidence of just how powerful that movement is this Saturday when they estimate that over 350,000 people will be marching. We may even witness more than that, but my understanding is there's about 2,000 buses arriving from around the country with women's who will be participating in the women's parade, and these are families and husbands, brothers, sons, and partners as well.
You're talking about the Women's March on Washington, which is happening this Saturday, January 21st in D.C., and then there's satellite marches not only around the country but around the world.
Right, right. Many,
many
coordinated.
The day after Trump is inaugurated.
Right. And I call it a parade because if you've ever been to a women's rally, it's very, very festive. It's very joyful. It's very uplifting. There's singing. There's a peaceful cooperation. There's art. There's poetry. There's So when I've taken, you know, uninitiated to rallies, they say, wow, this is like a parade and it's a lot of fun. And I wish I had come to these before. But the women's movement's not the only one that is a part of this beautiful civil society fabric. Of course, we have civil rights groups, civil liberties groups, Black Lives Matter groups, the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC, and the Puerto Rican citizens, and Native American citizens, and many, many other great civilizing movements here in the United States. And all of them will be coming together.
It's an amazing tapestry when you think about it, all the active people out there. It's let's talk a little bit more about the teach-in at AU, and then I want to come back to the Women's March coming up. But you had, what was it? You had hundreds of people at AU this past weekend. How many were there? What kind of people were there? Is it all these representatives from the different aspects of civil society committed to nonviolent action?
Well, 933 people RSVP'd on the Facebook page.
Wow.
But then, you know, many more people cycled in and out over the course of the 3 days. There were people tabling. There were people serving food for free, people providing child care, because that's the kind of community we are, where we all support each other. People are really seeing themselves as part of a greater community of the human race. And so I don't know if we have a complete head count on how many people participated. And then people who got off work in the evenings also stopped by, and then people came by the church. And I wasn't able to keep track of all of the registrants for that. And then, of course, all these mini trainings that are going on around the city this week as a continuation of that.
Right, so you probably had over 1,000 people there.
Most likely, yeah.
That's impressive. And one of the people who kind of crashed the party is someone from the Breitbart, the phony news propaganda group, crashed your party and explain what they did. They're taking some videos and then edit it to make it look like you were a violent group. Tell us what happened there.
Yes, I don't want to give them too much amplification because I feel that is also what happened with this recent election, that the media ends up giving the worst elements of the human race a megaphone and an amplifier or a microphone. To me, they're rather pathetic that they have to go to such lengths to try and discredit peace movements. But we have seen this many, many times before. We saw provocateurs during the anti-war movement in the 60s, in the Black Panther movement, in the Black Lives Matter movement. We even know that officials and police infiltrated social movements. We know that the Baltimore police showed up to anti-nuclear meetings and anti-war meetings. During the Bush years, there's been a lot that have come out in the papers that undercover agents or, you know, provocateurs plant themselves. And, you know, I saw it in Ferguson as well, where peaceful protesters were singing and marching, and somebody from out of town who was not part of the movement threw bottles from the back of the crowd to try to hit the police. And the Ferguson protesters surrounded them and sang and shamed that person till he fled. And, this goes on all the time. So, yes, there are the very, very sad, pathetic elements who feel that they have to distort the message of those of us who are trying to advance human rights. And they put out misinformation campaigns or disinformation campaigns. It's hate propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to feel sorry for them. I mean, there's something clinically wrong with them. There's something clinically wrong with them that they have to go to such lengths. So they will doctor and Photoshop and stitch together different sound bites to distort. And we saw this with ACORN, the Association for Community Organizers of Reform Now. They sent undercover provocateurs into the ACORN office, and they
being the Breitbart phony news propaganda group.
Well, it wasn't exactly it was James O'Keefe.
James O'Keefe.
They're part of a whole network of hate groups. And I think the Southern Poverty Law Center does a very good job of tracking these hate groups and right-wing militarist groups, very misogynistic. They sought to destroy ACORN, one of the best inner-city organizing networks of community organizers in the United States that helped tenants fight for their rights for fair housing and jobs and healthy food in their communities. ACORN was shut down by the right wing in Congress. They lost all their funding. Mm-hmm. And then this same group deceived Planned Parenthood and posed as somebody other than who they really were. And as you know, that's been all over the papers the last couple of years. They lied and cheated and misframed what Planned Parenthood was doing. And
I agree with you. I don't want to give these people too much attention, but at the same time, we've got Steve Bannon, one of the masterminds behind this hate propaganda, is now at the right hand of our president-to-be starting tomorrow. So I just want our listeners to be aware that this is out there and be very careful when you're watching news or watching something, particularly on the Internet. There is a lot of fake news out there, you know, some from the Russians, some from the hate groups domestically. So be very careful. I mean, the fact that your incredible work there at American University, which is all about nonviolence, that they could, slice and dice it to pretend that you're promoting violence is really ugly. But we just, all of us need to be aware when we hear something, double-check who's the source. How do we know if that's real or not?
That's right. And you also have to be careful if you're at movement events and if you're at peace events and nonviolence trainings, there will be people who seek to undermine and to sabotage. And you, again, it's very, very sad that they have to go to such lengths, but we have our integrity, and that's what we have to stay focused on, to be clear and focused and centered. The best of us put our best foot forward and the best face of the human race forward.
Right.
And we, you know, nonviolence teaches us that you must be transparent and honest. You never seek to deceive your opponent. You always share with your opponent what you intend to do, whereas mm-hmm. with the right wing, they try to practice subterfuge and all kinds of deception. So we want to distinguish ourselves as much as we can from those who practice hate.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Very good. Very good. I appreciate your work there. So tell us a little bit about how the mobile nonviolence training, and particularly what's happening with the people who are coming down to the Women's March by bus. Are we doing some mobile teach-ins on the buses?
Yes, we've put together a whole beautiful packet, and all credit goes to Nadine Block and other nonviolence trainers. They've put together a really, really beautiful packet, which is kind of a mini training while you're traveling many hours on the bus. You can begin an educational workshop on wheels.
Oh, I love it.
Yes, yes. So it's it can last anywhere from 20 minutes to 60 minutes, but it breaks down different parts of the history of nonviolence, the tools of nonviolence, the tactics and strategies of nonviolence, to give people a sense of their own power, their own competencies and skill sets. We can tap into the great assets and resources that people already possess. So, you know, part of the training is to turn to a neighbor and to begin to organize on the bus. Should anything go awry at the anti-Trump protests on Friday or at the women's parade on Saturday, you can form an affinity group. People can keep track of each other in the crowd. You would have a buddy system. And the training goes on to ask, you know, what major nonviolent movements do you know of in history that have really changed the course of human events? And you share, you know, four or five in a conversation there on the bus with a neighbor or a small cluster of others on the bus with you, and begin to pull back the lens and see that we're part of a much greater chain of human events, much greater chain of people power coming down through the centuries that have really tried to make the planet more peaceful and just. And then we get into the effectiveness of nonviolence. Where has it worked? Where has it gotten really, really concrete resist authoritarian regimes, dictatorships, and really problematic corporations, or the kinds of violent campaigns against people, whether it be the kinds of environmentalists that have been shot and killed in Central America. How can we organize against that? I don't know if you heard the news this morning, but yet another beautiful environmental leader in El Salvador was killed, and last year in Honduras. Yeah, these are the winners of the Goldman Environmental Award.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, and so we have been able to practice nonviolence to, you know, bring down apartheid in South Africa, to stop nuclear weapons in Europe, to advance labor rights, to protect the environment, and to, you know, protect human rights. So we share those stories on the bus. We will be, and sharing the strategies underlying it and doing some practice, obviously, not a full-scale, large group exercise like we normally would do at a training, but to actually ask, what will you do if you find that you're confronted with a violent counter-protester who are against women's rights, how do you mm-hmm. respond? What are some of the kinds of de-escalation techniques that can be tried?
That's fabulous. Well, I'm delighted to hear you've helped put together this workshop on wheels. I think that's a great thing to do. For people who are very upset, and I know it's most of our listeners very upset about the fact that Trump is becoming our president tomorrow, like it or not, and they want to get involved and do something. I mean, they're maybe willing to come to D.C., or maybe they want to do something where they are. And we talked a little bit about the Women's March on Washington, which is in D.C. and in so many cities and towns across the country. What other things do you know are happening this week that people can participate in?
Well, there are lots of community dialogues happening in cities and towns across the country, and I would plug into the local congregations. If you are part of a faith-based community, I would tap into your local universities. There's all kinds of teach-ins going on. I would talk with your local Sierra Club, your local League of Women Voters. There's so many groups. Please contact the American Civil Liberties Union. Please contact the NAACP. Find out what existing groups are in your community and strengthen them and participate. There's no reason for us to go off in a million different directions when there are really, really important established groups doing amazing things, Greenpeace or the network of indigenous environmental organizations across the Great Plains states. There are alliances of all kinds, National Organization for Women, the Fund for Feminist Majority. Go to these websites, look at what they might be organizing. If you don't find anything in your village or town, call a meeting. I was amazed when, you know, there was nothing being said right after the election. I called a meeting in my neighborhood and everyone showed up. They were so upset. And also MoveOn.org has organized community conversations in people's homes. Last Sunday, there were thousands of them organized across the country. In the smallest places, right after the election as well, MoveOn.org put out the call and people showed up. And they're just living room conversations with your neighbors. Yeah, that's important to strengthen a sense of community. I think it will also become increasingly important if the Trump regime establishes a Muslim registry or begins to deport Hispanics. The three top bishops of the Episcopal Church in the state of Virginia held a meeting right after the election, and I went to it. This is a rather conservative state, although we've gone blue for Obama twice and Hillary, thank goodness, because of grassroots campaigning and organizing and door knocking. And these three top bishops declared to over 1,000 parishioners from the Hispanic community that they will practice nonviolent resistance against deportation of their congregations, and they will offer safe sanctuary for those that are being menaced or threatened. And so I was very, very proud of the Episcopal bishops, but they're not the only faith-based community that's stepping up and stepping out. All of the Jewish rabbis across the country and hundreds and thousands of Jewish congregations have said if Trump institutes a Muslim registry, they will put their names in the list. They see the parallels between the beginning of the Third Reich uh-huh. in Germany. Everyone should go down to the Holocaust Museum and see how fascism started in Germany and across Europe. They began with these registries. They made the Jews register, and then they began to dehumanize them further and further through the propaganda. So if Trump and his cabinet members institute a Muslim registry, the Jewish congregations across the country intend to overwhelm that database with their own names, and others, of course, will join them. So there's resistance coming from so many different corners of civil society in the U.S. and congregations.
And that's a practical thing that all of us can do. I was remembering when Trump talked about the registry for Muslims. I remembered during the Nazi reign against the Jews and the gays and the union organizers, and that the king of Denmark, when the Nazis said we got to have all the Jews wear this star, the king of Denmark went around wearing a star on himself.
That's right.
And
and
that was his signal to the people, you know, what, I'm doing this, you can all do this too, and they won't be able to tell who really is Jewish and who isn't. So it's like, well, whatever they're doing, I'll sign that registry, I'll wear that star, and if enough of us do it, the whole thing becomes ineffective.
Right, and they did the same thing in Bulgaria, and the king of Bulgaria refused to participate with the Nazis, and of course they poisoned him and took him up in a plane and without a oxygen mask. And so there have been a lot of examples of nonviolent resistance in history where entire populations would not go along with authoritarian regimes, and the teachers wouldn't teach, and the bankers wouldn't bank, and the railroads wouldn't run, and grocery stores shut down, or they had worker slowdowns, or they had stay-at-home campaigns and strikes.
Well,
and
excellent historical background to know now. We just have 1 minute to go, and I do know that in Washington, D.C., after the Women's March this Saturday through Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening, and Sunday, down at All Souls Church. If you're in D.C., go down to All Souls Church. There's going to be all kinds of teach-ins and workshops on these kinds of issues. So if you can get to D.C., I encourage you to go down there. And you're involved in some direct action, are you not? You want to tell us very briefly about that?
Well, it's more complicated than is required in one minute. But, yes,
okay.
I would also say that our artists are our greatest resource as well, and we're going to see a lot of beautiful lyrics, movies, songs, dances, performances coming out in the coming years and in the coming months. And we know that that's how we ended slavery in England. It was three key communities coming together to converge. It was the clergy, it was the intellectuals, and it was the artists. And that's how
all the time we have. Thank you so much for being with us, Barbara Wien.
Bye-bye. Thank you.